Hey guys, thanks to joining another episode of Unpacked Podcast. I'm Arvin, an investment partner at Geodesic Capital, a mid to late stage growth fund in Silicon Valley.
And this is Vignesh. I'm a partner at Sierra Ventures, an early stage B2B focused fund. We'd like to introduce Mahe Bayireddy, the CEO of Phenom People, as our guest today. Sierra's had the pleasure of working with Mahe since 2015, and we've had the privilege of watching Mahe operate up close. Phenom today is a global force with over 1,000 employees and powering talent acquisition for over 80 of the global 2,000, and is a rarity in modern SaaS when it comes to scaling efficiently. And we hope to share some of this wisdom with you today. Thanks for joining us, Mahe. How are you doing today?
Awesome. Pretty good, Vignesh. Pretty good, Arvin. Nice meeting you both.
Yeah.
On the podcast.
No, we're really looking forward to this conversation. And you know, I think probably the best place to start, and I think was where we started, was love to hear your story. How did you get into being an entrepreneur, and what has you excited about building, or what got you excited about building companies?
Cool. As a kid, like, I'm born in India, so my dad used to own a pharmacy. And when I'm 10, I used to open the pharmacy, and I pretty much know every drug, where it is placed and what is it used for, even though I don't know most of the diseases, including pregnancy, really well. So, but I used to give these medications based on prescriptions, and I used to think I'm doing three things. The first one is I'm doing puzzles by looking at prescriptions, like where they're placed and what the drugs means, and if I don't have, which drug I have to really pick. So the combinations or whatever it is. The second thing is there is a wow factor. Somebody gives you a prescription. Wow, a kid can give prescriptions. And in 2 seconds, it will turn into fear. Oh my God, what this kid will do to my life. And yeah, maybe I'll get killed. And any other part of the world, you'll be arrested. Like in India, you can do it. So I used to think about the wow and the fear and also the puzzle. That's what really motivated to be like open a store. And that was the clear motivation why I built a business all throughout my life. But we are very clear, like we'll build businesses from childhood because that's how I grew up as a kid.
And we being you and your brother, it's interesting. I mean, you guys kind of pivoted your way multiple times to get to what Phenom is today. You got a company right before you did Phenom that didn't work out. You know, I'm curious for you, what was the biggest learnings for you after that first company failed as you started, I guess, iMomentus as it was known before it became Phenom? What were the biggest lessons that you learned from your first company that you translated when you started Phenom?
So if you really look at like the first company, what we built was about like patient recruiting. How do you recruit patients to a clinical trial? And the most important thread what we ran there was to understand a patient, there were four sides of data what you have to really converge to really understand where the patients can sit, which is basically a doctor's office data, a hospital data, and then an insurance data, and also your pharmacy's data. You buy the data, which is de-identified, and you project where the patients are. And that business actually has failed, but the concept was, if you really look at data from multiple different segments and different perspectives, you'll understand the core infrastructure in a much more authentic way. And that was the thesis of that particular business. And we took the same thing and applied for true recruiting. If you want to understand talent, you have to understand candidate, employee, HR, and the manager, and only then you can really understand talent effectively. So if you look at, like, even though that's a failure on a different industry and a different domain, we took the same thesis and applied here, and we never deviated from that core thesis. And that is what actually helped us to grow the company.
I think that word thesis is really, really interesting. And you know, I was reading something recently, and one of the interesting comments that came out of it, and I'm curious how you thought about it with respect to Phenom, is that the thesis is really important when you start the company. Oftentimes, like when you start the company, you have this like, hey, I really have this interesting problem, but the thesis itself may not be fully fleshed out in the sense of how does this actually translate into a big company. And when you started the company, and I remember this very clearly, a lot of people did not like HR tech. HR tech was a very unsexy market with, I mean, a few big exits, but really was just a market with a lot of dead bodies. And I'm curious about the thesis that you built around HR tech and why you picked HR tech as a market, given the challenges.
So there are two things I've really looked at. Like, one is the thesis, what I really believed in is about, like, if you build the network of data, you basically can really predict in a different format. The second equation, what I really felt was HR is, if you look at like 101 on Silicon Valley, most of the companies, actually 70 to 80% of the companies are only in three different departments of an enterprise: sales, marketing, and IT. That's what all the VCs are funded. The rest are HR, procurement, finance. Like, there are a couple of other departments within enterprise which are not super well funded comparatively when you really look at the cohort of the top three, because that's where the enterprise spend is. So it's like, we as a company spend $1.8 million on sales related SaaS products per year. Like, a major company which is having like probably over 50,000 employees won't even spend that kind of a budget on overall HR. So what we need to really build is, we need to build a product which is optimized for that particular price point, but can create a much more bigger infrastructure. We, in our product, we have a CRM, which is what recruiters use. The data what it holds is like 10 times more than what Salesforce can hold for the same size of a company. Because people applying for a job and people really selling for a customer, they're not equal in numbers. They're in 10x in different value and volume. So what we found is, if we have to find that kind of a niche, we can really build a unique moat where we can really offer a product which is at a different price point, but also can really do innovation at a different rate. Mm-hmm. And if we can do that, then we have a sustainable business. And that was what actually worked for us.
Yeah, I think that's actually a really interesting insight. And actually, in some ways, it's very, very interesting and apropos to the climate today. When you think about all the AI companies that are popping up, and I think that's probably the number one question that we talk about now in our partner meetings and when companies come in, is this thing like a real company that has real IP, or is this just a wrapper around ChatGPT? And I know, Mahi, you spend a ton of time in AI, and we've had some good discussions at the board around AI probably, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, before it became probably a very hot topic in most boardrooms. And I was always curious about why, and like, what and who convinced you to even think about AI that early on? Like, why did you view it as such a key for Phenom?
So my undergrad and grad are in computer science, so that's the only language I know. My first job I got as a mortgage and insurance company. Mm-hmm. They give mortgages, which is called as GMAC, GM's arm for mortgage industry, but it's no more existing. What I did is, my first job ever I got was building a search engine for mortgage loans using Lucene search engine. It is like Elasticsearch or whatever we call right now. Solr don't even exist at that time. It's even what is the core infrastructure. I used to really build the search infrastructure for all mortgage applications. That was my exposure towards, this is in 2002 and 2003. So because of that, like, I have a good understanding what search can do, what AI can do in certain formats. And then when I'm really building my last business, it's all about projecting data in terms of where can be a patient, which is a data heavy infrastructure. It's all about a prediction and really build algorithms. So we have experience on that for a very long time, even before this business. And that's why I'm saying it is all about a network. And when we're really coming in, we thought like, hey, where is that we can use AI in our infrastructure? The first one, what we really did is, how can we build a job search way better than anybody else in a B2B market? And even today, nobody in the market actually does better than us in that particular arena, both in search and personalization of any job infrastructure. And that's where we got like the unique edge. People started recognizing it's not something very, very fancy, but it's very simple, but it actually works. And we have seen tremendous outcomes based on the thesis of what e-commerce did, where how do you do personalization? How do you do A/B testing? How do you do multi-arm bandits in the back end? All those things helped us to think through what infrastructure we need to build.
I'll jump in with one. I mean, today's climate, given that we are navigating both profitability and growth, right? Which then associatively, when you're thinking of building a product embedded with AI, how do you sort of navigate being clinical about, okay, maybe these streams, work streams, you know, are right for AI versus XYZ work streams don't. And so, and that sort of has an implication on how you sort of, that transcends down the organization so that, you know, you're managing your R&D cost, you're managing your SG&A, et cetera, right? So any color on that might be helpful for the listeners.
Yeah, so the first most important thing what we really think about in our flow is how do we make our product really constantly add value to the user? And all users are not same in using the product. So we look at the personas more efficiently. And there is one specific point what we believe in. In the knowledge worker use case, generative AI will impact anywhere between 30 to 40% of productivity gains. Not in frontline worker use case. Frontline worker use case, generative AI is a waste of time. Like if you're working in delivering DPDHL logistics or like boxes, or you're working for Walmart, or you're working for like Southwest Airlines in RAM as a RAM agent, what is generative AI going to do? It's pretty much useless because there is no application. So those are our customers. But the people who use our product in the backend, which are the recruiters, which are the managers, which are the talent management, which think about the employees, how they can grow. They're all knowledge workers. We can improve their productivity 20 to 30% guaranteed. And how do we do it? We cannot do outside the workflow what they're really using today. We take the existing workflow, we think about which pieces can be automated, which pieces can be more intelligent, and which key pieces can be more generative so that you don't need to do most of the stuff. And that 20 to 30% is what is the constant thought process what we go after. Now, here is where the catch is. The context is super critical. What I mean by that, if you are a recruiter who is hiring, let's say, developers, the way you use generative AI is a bit different than if you are really recruiting for people who are working in frontline use cases. Like because here, everything is campaign basis in a frontline use case, whereas in a knowledge worker use case, you won't really do everything automated. If you're hiring a nurse, you should be very personalized. Now, when you come to talent management, which is about retention of employees, the way you really broadcast which cohort of employees you have to go after is very different. What I mean by that, if an employee has joined a company 6 months back, the way you write an email is different from an employee who is there in the company for the last 6 years. And that context of how you help a manager, how you help HR, how you help talent management in retention is different from how you actually help in recruiting. So those contexts, if you can really build effectively, generative AI can definitely make in the HR space a lot more like impact than we have ever seen, especially in the productivity side.
Mahed, that's actually an important point, and I think you're scratching at the surface of something you were touching on earlier, which is around the moat. And I just want to unpack that a little bit, right? Which is, there's certain context that you understand as phenom because you know that employee A has been with the company for 6 years versus 6 months doing X, Y, Z. And while generative AI probably has some of the context or ability to write specifically to that tone, I'm curious about, like, if you were advising a founder that's just getting started around to build a B2B SaaS company today, but where should they be focusing in terms of, like, is it data? Is it getting an access into the workflows? Is it broader knowledge of the organization? Like, What do you do to build a real moat then in B2B SaaS today?
So I think like the major infrastructure, what everybody is trying is productivity and efficiency. If we don't understand the user use case so well, there is no impact at all. So like Jasper is a really cool one. It generates a lot of content, but that's the only enterprise software which actually have some scale. Like how many generative AI, what do you call as use cases actually scaled right now? Not many to a different magnitude until unless you have a workflow which is concrete. So, and there are also like three or four different plays to really play here. The first is, are you using a wrapper on top of your existing infrastructure? That is very easy because like to call OpenAI like APIs or to call like Cohere or to call like somebody else, like it's a sixth grader job. You don't need serious engineering. That's very simple. But the second notion is it's more about like how do you really build a context through knowledge graphs and vector spaces, vector databases to really create a memory and really think about like which particular LLM you have to call at what particular spot and which will really give you an edge in terms of pricing versus which can really build a good context. Like let's take a simple example. Bard is damn good if you're really doing a financial analysis compared to OpenAI can't even touch its ability to really pull. It's because it has access to Google finances data in a much more authentic format. Like you can ask about what are the top like six NRR companies or what is HubSpot NRR for the last 3 years, Bard can give. Like ChatGPT is not that great at those kinds of data sets. But if you want to write a poem, like ChatGPT is way better. So you have nuances within these kinds of things. So what happens is where to use which one is one determination factor, which everybody has to think about. Then there is another slice of business, which is all about you have to build your own LLMs. So, and it is guaranteed every domain will build an LLM and almost every department can build an LLM. Whether they build the large language model or they'll build a slice of a model, which is much more specific, is what has to be seen in the future, but that's going to happen. On top of it, like people are really talking about LLMs at the rate of a country level or a culture level. And that will really make things much more complex than simplified. Now, because the narrative of how you really structure the language is all right now based on North America. But that is because the RHLF, whatever the reinforcement learning feedback loop is actually mostly originated in North America. And if you really go by country, it'll become much more complex. So, but anyway, what our point of view is, we really look at three different shots for our business. And when I'm really giving an advice to an entrepreneur, which particular space you are playing in the application layer. Like I'm only talking about application layer. If you want to build a different infrastructure, that's a different story. But you, where you really know the user really well and where you have the data sets about that user context in a much more authentic format, and then how do you influence and really intersect into their current flow of events? Because you cannot really build completely entire product line on generative AI, leaving like whatever they're using, because change management is so hard, even though it is chatbot.
Yeah. I think that's a good lesson. And I guess maybe one more specific question around learnings for a founder, given such a rapid pace of development, one of the things that I think is starting to become harder is to define the wedge. I mean, you obviously talked about it from the context of like, hey, you just got to really understand that user's workflow. You mentioned yours, right, which was search and personalization. And, you know, when we were early on in the journey of Phenom, and we just go to customers and, you know, customers' career pages at that time were really just not very good and function of like technology at the time. And so we found a really, really smart wedge. But, you know, for us at that time, we were really competing with agencies. I mean, we weren't competing with software companies. It feels like, you know, you throw a rock and there's a software to do everything today. And so I'm curious, like if you were to do it all over again and start from zero today, how would you go about even figuring out what the, like, what the wedge is? Like, where do you start to figure out, like, the, like, your edge today?
See, the one thing I constantly think about, like, even the last time when I started and right now, even if I start all the way fresh, is like, what is the new data set I will really create, which don't exist? That will give me a leverage which like most of the industry right now don't have. I'll give an example. When we started the company Phenom, we went with candidate experience as the first use case. The reason for that was the data set for candidates was very poor. And we thought, like, if we can really build that data set very effectively, we can do prediction a bit better and experience can be a lot relevant. So what is the data set that don't exist that you will really go after? And you can really collect because of the generative AI infrastructure, what you're really building. The second most important thing, what worked for Phenom was what integrations we have to make and how well we will do it. And if you don't make the existing data integrate to your infrastructure, you will never get the context right. So, because that's where people are living right now. So that is the second thing. If you look at, like, a lot of AI companies actually failed because it's not because they didn't do the prediction right. They didn't do the data quality and the data coverage right. And the data quality and the data coverage comes only when you have the integration infrastructure very, very effective. Look at, like, whichever company which is successful, it's all because of the existing data integration is much more faster and the coverage is humongous. Those are the only ones who are successful.
It's funny, I think that touches on something interesting I read the other day, which is that LinkedIn is probably one of the most underrated companies of all time. I mean, I think the comment was, think about the last time you actually used Indeed or any other product when it comes to job searching or even social networking in the professional context. They just have such a stranglehold on everybody's ability to connect with each other personally. And so I think that idea of think about what the end game is from a data perspective, I think does become a really, really valuable, really valuable asset to the company. Now, obviously you have to execute there, but I guess setting the North Star is just as important. And I'm curious about, you know, with Phenom, we always had a very simple but powerful message. It's find a billion people a job. And I'm curious how important that vision was to the culture, to the brand, to the actually ability to scale the company to where it's gotten to today.
So, like, helping a billion people find the right job was the core theme why the company exists. And the purpose was super helpful throughout our journey of what we're really building and why we exist, but also how we can connect to a customer and what's the biggest impact what we need to create. And based on that, how the product evolution actually happened, because to help a billion people, so we have to really start with a candidate, but we have to really take all the way to an employee and their retention and they staying with the company for as long as possible, but also think about their career path, whether within the company or outside. And that really made the whole product to expand to a platform of what it is today. And it's only from the purpose. And the other thing is, it's also really very meaningful for the employees to work in the company. So they're really looking for something bigger than just really building technology. And that actually helped us in terms of how to think and how to make each particular team accountable to the actual goal, which is the purpose. And it's always important how emotionally they connect with our thought process rather than we being another company just really looking to raise money or become big and be profitable. And as long as HR connects to that particular perspective, that's a very meaningful thing.
Did it help you with actually getting the first few customers? I mean, I'm curious about, in the early days, how powerful is the vision when it comes to actually being able to sell to customers and getting customers excited to work with you, and for that matter, employees when you try to hire really, you know, great talent?
Yeah, until we become $50 million, the purpose was like is only for us an art star. Our customers were thinking like, hey, these guys talk too big. They don't understand. But there are some people who are actually allowed us because of what we're really saying. But it's not about the purpose just. It's also about like, what is the product we built and how different it is compared to what they have ever seen. So the first 1,000 pitches of the customer pitches, I was there almost on everyone, at least 90% of them. At least 150 of those 1,000 customer like prospects actually got up and clapped for our sales pitch and our vision and our purpose. So that is because there is an emotional connection to what the purpose is, where the product is, how it is progressing, to what the vision is. When those things connect, people don't think we are selling. And that was super helpful.
You know, in that context, and one of the things that I always remark about when I think about Phenom as a company is, as we come to the board meetings and, you know, as you guys shifted from office to, I guess, three offices that we saw, you always saw a lot of the same people, right? Like you just do. I think the retention at Phenom was really, really solid. And I'm curious about your framework around hiring people in the context of the culture and the vision of the business. Like, how do you find people that like that fit the mold well, but can actually help you scale with the business?
So initially, like the founders were interviewing most of the people. We created our own values of what the culture should sustain. But what we used to think is, who can exhibit the values what we have, and how the values will translate into behaviors, and can we really find those behaviors in what they did in their life, whether how they construct their life story or how they explain about what the proudest moments of their life and how they did it, how detailed they really go in. So we try to really look at the behaviors can be exhibited for what the values they lived for. That was the primary notion what we really ran. And we never used to think every new employee has to really meet all the five values which we used to really think about are important. We used to think even if they have two or three matching and if they're really intense enough, we can hire them and then really see like what the other values we can really bring to the table. And that actually helped us. But over a period of time, what happened is we actually inspired from, as we're scaling from Amazon Bar Raiser, and we created an N2 process. So which is a not normal hiring process where we basically have a team of people. We have N2 leaders who basically really go in and almost like a bar raiser, look at like, are these people really a culturally match or not a match? And if they're a match, like why it is, and they have a veto power to really reject anybody not to join. And that actually helped us a lot in terms of how to think about whom to bring in and whom not to, and how we really do this, what you call as hurdles about hiring, and really look at like, we just don't really look at like what their strengths are. We also look at what their weaknesses are. It's not because not to hire. Everybody has weaknesses, and it's a very common thing because we are human beings at the end of the day, so that we can match people better, strengths and weaknesses, so that we can build better teams, so that people can grow like leaning on each other rather than each one is individual contributor on their own and nobody cares about anybody.
You've always been a student of org design, right? And you've always like thought about org design, but I think the way you thought about org design probably changed at different phases of the company. And I'm curious, I have to have a set of values for the employees that you hire from day one, that otherwise you can't hire effectively. But I'm curious as to how do you think about the timing of all this, right? Like if you're telling a founder that's like at a million in ARR today, do you tell them like, hey, you should be spending your time thinking about like org design? Should you be spending your time like, you know, going out and like selling? Like how, where does the stack rank in terms of priorities for a founder that's still early on in the journey?
Yeah, until 15 million, don't even think about org. Just keep building and you create a mess and then you clean up. So, and like at 5 million, you will really know whom to hire because you have failed enough. Like how many of our books really come, nobody knows how to hire really well. it's like marriage. Like, how do you know whom to pick as your spouse? I've read like 200 books. Like, I have never seen anybody being successful, even for dating, forget about marriage. So it's just the same thing. Hiring is a trial and error mechanism where you find patterns which resonate with you, and those things will really turn into some things which are values. The values are nothing but they're not coming from sky. It's about like what worked for you and what didn't work for you, and what to avoid and what to keep in perspective. And then how do you really set those behaviors based on your past experiences and past patterns? And then over a period of time, you basically use others to validate them and improve them. So from that perspective, you constantly have to think about like each particular segment of a size of a company. Like, blitzscaling actually defines in a very effective way, which people can really easily understand. You're basically playing different sizes of sports you are really playing. Either you're playing in little leagues or big leagues, or then you're really going into NFL or pros. Each particular segment, you have to think your organization differently or chat differently, because you have leaders of leaders of leaders. At that point of time, you have to think differently. Like, for us, what happened is we brought in mentors at every spot and a different set of mentors, but we have some who are constant, and that actually helped based on their role. I'll give a quite recent example. We hired Colin, who wrote a book called Working Backward. He worked at Amazon, and he used to be the shadow of Jeff Bezos or whatever. We hired him not because he worked at Amazon. We hired him because he worked at Amazon when Amazon has 1,000 employees. Mm-hmm. Amazon at 1,000,000 employees, a lot of people don't even know what was Amazon at 1,000 employees. And we don't want Amazon 1,000,000 employee culture and a rule set, because at that scale, you don't even know what the founder did. Mm-hmm. So we want at the 1,000 employee level, what actually the founder's intentions were to create what the culture was. And if you can take those examples in an effective format, that will help you to scale.
I think that's a really, really insightful comment on finding the right mentors for the right state of businesses. I think we often have this like, hey, let's install an independent board member. And obviously in our case, it worked out really well with who we have. But you know, I think there's the advisor page on a lot of startup pitches tend to be more for look at the people and the names that I have, as opposed to here's why I have them. So I think that's a really insightful comment.
No, I think I also kind of walk away with this is a unique perspective, Mahe, that about don't even think about org design until you get to 50 and clear the mess afterwards. But you know, just on vision and culture, what approach has worked for you? I mean, like, are you the kind of person who likes to go down to the grassroots and sort of, you know, inculcate that within the younger employees and from a tenure point of view? Or are you kind of a bit of a train the trainer model, right? Whereby you have a bunch of deputies and sort of let the culture and vision be effervescent. I mean, go and trickle down the organization.
Yeah, the most important thread at this stage versus like 5 years back, the stages were a bit different. At that time, like, we were actually hiring like below 500 employees. We were almost involved in every hiring decision, me or my co-founders. So at that point of time, we can really involve a different segment. So we can go to all the way to every level of hiring. Now, what we did is, as we are in 1,000 right now, we started really feeling like after 500, we have to make sure there are trainers we have to train. And that's where the N2 model really came in, where we have N2 trainers who basically can really set up, hey, these are the values what we live for. But the most important thread what worked for me was every all hands, I'll start with the purpose, and I'll really talk about values, and I'll really talk about values specifically about like how those behaviors have been adopted in which particular place. Or if I'm really hiring somebody and if there is an hiring hurdle, we basically talk about why I don't think this person is a right fit based on which particular value, which behavior hasn't been exhibited. Or if you're really giving somebody a promotion and why we are giving a promotion and what are the 3 or 4 things they really did that is so unique for the company. So as long as you connect those dots across the company on multiple segments and you make the leaders really resonate in the same format, it actually works more effectively. Initial stage, all entrepreneurs are really, really goes to the details, especially like a type of personality who I am. There are some who are different maybe, but right now we cannot go to that level. So one of the complex problems in entrepreneurship is you have to evolve as a person and really leave what you really love to do for the growth of the company. And a lot of people don't like that. That's why they need somebody else to do their job.
I think that's it's a really interesting comment and an interesting question. And obviously, you know, you always hear the stories of like, hey, founder was replaced. And a lot of it oftentimes does come to the question of like, hey, is this person good from like 0 to 1, 1 to 10, 50 to 10 to 50, 50 to 100? I'm curious, like, are there tips, tricks? Like, what do you do? Like, how do you like sit back and reflect at every step of the company to then be like, okay, I didn't do this right and I need to do this better for the next step and come up with a plan to actually be able to evolve with the business?
The one thing I have did is I really read these autobiographies and biographies of a lot of founders. So the one common element of most of the founders are they're arrogant and they're mostly stupid. And very few times they will be right and they're okay with it. And like how aggressive you are based on that, your success will be is what I have really understood in the realm of that possibility. But whoever are super adaptable. So as the company is growing, people who work for you want your job, not the title, but the job you're doing. But when you love the job you're doing, you don't want to give it away. And that's what creates friction in the company, actually. So, but if you're like, what is evolution of a person is all about, can you really give away what you already have because others are aspiring for it? But make sure you delegate only when they're ready. And as long as you have that check, you will do in a much more effective format. So my reflections are always about who is ready for what spot, rather than at each stage, I have to change a person. Can they evolve for the needs of the enterprise of today, whether it is sales or engineering or it's product or whoever it is? And if they have still the fire and they can still really grow and they can really fill their weaknesses with the people who are better than them for those weaknesses, they will continuously evolve. And the most important thing of evolution is awareness. If you are not even aware about your own stupidity, there is no way anybody can grow.
Very interesting. Maya, I think that sort of strikes a chord on a particular topic, which is very unique in your situation. And I've had an experience of backing two brothers before, and we had a good outcome. How do you sort of, there's a family element to it, right? How do you sort of navigate a bit of the professional and to the extent you're comfortable sharing, of course, because I personally also come across a family kind of founders, husband, wife, or brothers, etc. So I think listeners might benefit from your perspective on this.
So me and my brother were like in businesses from childhood together. Like, and the most important thing what we understood in business is it's not about the fame or the money. It's about when you have nothing, how you stand strong by not showing the cards like you're not really in a good spot. Like that is one thing which we learned as kids. Like when my father's business was failure, nobody will know. Like the business has failed because the next business has to start. So like you basically maintain that tempo. And my strengths are his weaknesses and his strengths are my weaknesses. So because of that, like our ego actually reduces. That doesn't mean we don't have ego. That's not the point. Like it actually gets a bit diluted. And we together will extend egos. That actually helps you as a team. So if you really look at like all my team, which reports to me, they all were hired for my weaknesses to really address for the strength of the company. So that we all are really building a very unique infrastructure of together we have superpowers. And that is what is more important than anything else. So what am I trying to say is I always look at this whole thing, whether they're relative or not, if you can really think about like how you can complement each other, it's more important in building a business, and that to a long-term durable business than anything else. And that's what actually helped me and my brother.
You mentioned the word ego a couple times there, and I want to just double click on that, because you know I think that's always you touched on it earlier as well. You know, when the company is going from 0 to 1 and then has to go from 1 to 10, one of the hard things for every founder is, well, I was doing everything, now I got to step back and not do everything and find people that can actually come in and you know do things that I don't do well better, or even things that I do well do better than me. I'm curious for you, what were your learnings? Like, you know, and we had these conversations a lot early on, right, when it came to hiring execs. And, you know, one of the things that we always had to struggle with in terms of finding the balance is bringing in a person versus like taking the risk of bringing in the person and, you know, having an impact on the org. And I'm curious, how do you objectively assess which things do you kind of give up control of first and bring somebody on to take over? And which things do you say like, hey, you know, I have to own this, you know, till we get to the next level of scale? I'm just curious about your philosophy when it comes to building the exec team to make sure that you optimize for success while minimizing the risk of adding, you know, of bringing on failure into the company.
Yeah, like as the company is progressing based on board meetings or our hands or like how the company is performing, you know where you're really, really weak. And in those areas, you have to really fill in with somebody who can bring strength. The problem with what happens when you really bring from outside is if you don't really bring the right person who can really reflect in the values, what you really set up. And there are a lot of people who know a lot more than what we know. There is no doubt about it. But they might not be a perfect fit for our style of working in terms of how we are conservative, in terms of how we spend, or how we hire, like, or how we think about like which particular play we have to play in the marketing versus sales. So if those philosophies were not aligned, like you can bring somebody who is very successful, and if your core philosophy really goes against each other, whatever you do, you cannot work together. So the most important thread is, are you philosophically aligned to each other for a common good? And if that happens, you can bring people really aggressively. There's also another notion: if you really bring a person, the existing person can leave really, really fast. Either the new person won't like your relationship with the founder, or they might not be strong enough based on what their strengths and weaknesses are. And that's a very common reflection, and they'll really replace them. And it's not always, at least 50, 60% of the time it happens. So now with that particular framework, what happens to the whole org is also what you have to think through, and what it comes with cost, what it comes with impact, and how fast you can really measure. To me, in any executive I hire, the first 6 months is what I'm mostly really spend time on. In 6 months, like what I hired for, what I felt in my recruiting process, based on all the people who interviewed, what the strengths and weaknesses are, in 6 months, I'll know, have we interviewed right or wrong? It's not what the person said. Anybody can say whatever they want, but what is our assessment is what we have to validate. And the assessment, again, is what the interview is drastically different, then we'll fail. If it is in sync, then you will be successful. So that is a critical spot. And then after 6 months, based on that, now what is the pressure point, what you really put on, based on where you want these people to really take a tangential shift? And if that happens, then you'll have the real core, what you call as team members, really form. But there are a lot of people whom we hired, especially in sales, even in product, we have disasters. But like, they didn't really cost us $5 million, like each mishire. But there are a lot of companies, a mishire will cost a full round of funding. Then you are doomed.
Yeah, I think that's it's an important lesson, I think, for any stage of scale. I guess one question, maybe just, you know, thinking about scaling a business in general. So we talked a lot about team, but if you just take a step back and you look at the different stages of the business, I'm curious, was it the 0 to 1, the 1 to 10, 10 to 50, 50 to 100, 100 plus? Like, what was the most challenging stage of scale for you? Or do you think about the stages of scale, you know, in a different framework? I'm curious of what was the most challenging stage of scale for you.
So each particular spot, the challenge is a different challenge. The reason is, in 0 to 1, nobody recognizes you. So, and nobody cares who you are. So you're really trying to find attention for people to recognize you. Until 10, like, you won't have proper recognition, whether it's recruiting or attracting customers, or even really building the right kind of product, or like hiring employees. Everywhere you will struggle. But what happens is, or even retention of employees also will be a struggle. But once you are 10 or 15, where like you're in a spot where you are okay, even investors for that matter is difficult at that time. But once after that, like, you're really thinking a bit differently right now. You want a structure in the organization. You think about scale. You have multiple products. You're not a single product organization. Once you cross 50, you have products which actually scale and you have products which didn't scale. So which products you have to really replace, and then what type of sales you have to really build in. So previously you are really selling one single thing in one particular format. Right now, as we are in a SaaS B2B business, we are really focused on elite customers. We have strategic enterprises, then we have majors. So you're basically right now thinking how to segment customers and what kind of products you need to build, what kind of tooling you need to build, what's the sales motion you have to put together, what's the marketing infrastructure you have to put together, and what's the support infrastructure you have to put together. They all vary. And that's where the complexity really comes in at our stage right now. But in the early stages, it's all about like, hey, the existing product has to work in the format what we need to. So each particular stage has a different problem. I'm not like, it's more interesting about like, how do you really look at like the next stage and what you don't know, and how do you unpack that? That's where your high is more than a challenge, because your unknown is so high and you're trying to know with the right kind of resources. And that challenge, when it really fulfills, it's cool. If not, like, you feel bad about it, because the outcomes are going to be worse.
I think, Mahe, you kind of like nicely led into this thought. I'm a believer that any organization, I've spent time in the military, so any organization has a peacetime and a wartime strategy. And so when you think about scaling, as we talked about, you know, to different scales of ARR, obviously there's a different mental mode of organizational building, you know, both from a attack point of view, but also defense. How do you defend your moat, etc.? So could you maybe, you know, give some color about what are the sort of peacetime work that you have done, the management has done, to sort of be ready for the wartime that technically we are in today because of the macro, right? I mean, enterprise budgets are a bit shrinking and all that nice stuff. So how do you think that the organization has prepared to have the muscle memory so that you can go and accelerate growth if you need to, or think about profitability if you need to? You know, it's a big question, but feel free to take it any way you want.
Yeah. So the wartime peacetime is the dual, like it's 0 or 1. I actually think there are 3 different notions in business. Like, I think a creation, you are in a process of elimination and in the process of continuation. So there are 3 components which you have to think about. In the creation mode, all you need is knowledge, and you have to really do it very effectively. It's when you're really building a new product or a new company, that's where the mode is actually important. Once it grows $10 million to $20 million, the most important thing is you have to start looking at what to eliminate and focus on which particular area you are really good at. at that point of time, entrepreneurs need extreme power to really execute what they should focus on so that they can really move to $50 million without distractions. And once you really cross $100 or $200 million, you really need to manage the infrastructure in a much more thoughtful way. So that's an organization structure in terms of now you're really talking about like peacetime and wartime. So if the market conditions are really bad, and now how do you really run the company? Whereas if the market is in a good state, how do you really run a company? So like most of the entrepreneurs are really good at wartime. The reason is most of the entrepreneurs I've read somewhere, they create order in chaos, but they also have another problem. If there is no chaos, they'll create chaos. So that's why they're good at like wartime more than a peacetime. But what most of the people have to do is you have to really set the agenda and really let the next level of leadership execute much more effectively. In a wartime, the most important founders has to be part of the whole play because you are much more frugal in terms of how to think about a business than most of the people who built organizations for a while. And frugality is important in wartime because resources are very highly constrained. But in peacetime, things are abundant, at least for that time factor. So you basically let the rope go a bit far. But we are not that then. As a company, we are always a bit conservative. So that is actually helping us both in wartime and peacetime. But there are some people who say like at peacetime, we didn't really spend enough money to like we can spend more money. And there was a lot of thought process in that. And to a certain extent, we might have did something, but I don't think based on current circumstances, we shouldn't have really did anything different. We should have really, what we're doing is actually giving good benefits for us, how we are disciplined and what we are really doing.
Got it. You know, I'm mindful of the time that you've spent with us, but if I could ask, I mean, and this is going to be relevant for the listeners, I've often heard, and I love your perspective, the CEO job is a very lonely job, right? And scaling it, being a founder and scaling it from zero to, you know, north of 100, how do you sort of recharge? How do you sort of regroup? How do you sort of come back rejuvenated, right? And those pieces of advice would be helpful for the listeners.
So I actually, a lot of people know in our organization or even Vignesh knows this, like I meditate every day, an hour, and every 3 months or every year, I'll have 12 days of silence. So I'll go to those retreats and all that stuff. So I won't even talk or spend any time. And people won't even know, like I've been to a retreat. It'll be a 4 days or 5 days. On a long weekend, I'll really take a retreat and then I'll just meditate for like, it's not 5 days straight. Each day you'll do like 6 to 8 hours of meditation. And then at the end of the event, like you write 5 advices to yourself. And those are the best advices you can write to yourself. Nobody can really give that kind of an advice because you know you so well. And that actually really gives you a reflection about like what to do and what not to do, or at least bring awareness of where you should spend time on. And that actually recharges me a lot. And that's one helpful thing. Actually encourages most of my leaders to also really do whatever the format they believe in, they should do it. That was also super helpful. Yeah, those are the two activities I do quite often. And we also do something called as this leadership events within the company, which are about like how we organize the company, what we really think about, which particular areas we have to, which are offsite or whatever it is. Those things also help in like just really doing the daily stuff.
Maya, I want to end with one last question that'll be a nice soundbite, which is, you know, look, you've obviously been through a number of different journeys, you know, in the lifetime of Phenom. But I think that 50 to 100 journey was really interesting. I mean, obviously, we were dealing with competitive challenges, dealing with macro challenges. We were dealt with COVID at that point in time. Given all that stuff that's happened to you, what are the one or two things that you would, piece of advice that you would give to founders or operators who are at that 50 to 50 million mark and are looking to get to that next stage of scale?
So a lot of times you have to really look at like how your competition really reflects. At $50 million, you have competitors within your space, and you have your partners who are way bigger will try and turn into competitors eventually. So you have to think that ecosystem in a much more different format than you ever used to. But if you really build a product which can retain itself with the users, not just with the customers, then it has a good edge. But the most important point is, how do you differentiate against your competitors in terms of your customer size is very critical. And if you can do that, then it becomes very effective in terms of sales motion, in terms of product releases, also in terms of how you raise funds. I will suggest one thing, don't really look at valuations more aggressively. Right now, nobody is looking at it. But if everything is really good, everybody only focuses on valuations to brag about. Nobody cares about your valuation in a wartime, because anyway, your valuation has no meaning at that point of time. But if you're really thoughtful about like what is the business you want to build and which is the investor you want to bring in and what the customers you have to focus on, irrespective of wartime or peacetime, you will build a resilient and durable business for a very long time. And if not, you have to take shortcuts too fast.
I think that's a really, really, really good way to wrap up the podcast. And I just want to thank you again for taking the time. It's been super fun to have this conversation. Obviously, you know, I've had the pleasure of working with you for a long time and seeing the inside baseball of Phenom, but I think it's always nice to step back and hear it from a 20,000 foot level as to how you kind of navigated all the challenges. And so I really want to thank you for the time, and thank you for listening to the Unpacked podcast.
Thanks a lot, Bhai. Appreciate
Thanks
it.
A lot. Thanks a lot for the opportunity, both Vignesh and Arvind.
Take care.